Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Reflecting on the connection between his work as a biblical scholar and climate change, my guest today has observed, the study of art, literature, and philosophy and religion offers rich resources for articulating what's at stake for the earth and all of its living inhabitants in our current moment. The texts left by ancient Judean sages and seers are no exception. That scholar is my faculty colleague, Professor Blake Cooey, who has been a member of the Gustavus Religion Department since 2009. He's also involved in the college's gender, women, and sexuality studies and comparative literature programs. Dr. Cooey earned his BA at Mercer University and his MDiv and PhD at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's an expert in the poetry and prophetic literature of the Hebrew Bible, with a focus on the book of Isaiah. His research in these areas has yielded an impressive body of scholarship, including journal articles, book chapters, conference papers, and two books, Reading the Poetry of First Isaiah, published by Oxford in 2015, and the edited volume with Elaine James, Biblical Poetry and the Art of Close Reading, published by Cambridge in 2018. Professor Cooey, needless to say, is also a teacher, and his Gustavus courses deal with such topics as the Bible, prophets, women, gender in the Bible, and God in the Hebrew Bible. He's also active in faculty service, including significant contributions to the creation of our new General Education Challenge curriculum. Seeing him in action in the latter role only increased my respect for his commitment to collegiality, the humanities, and undergraduate education. And though now on sabbatical, he's kindly agreed to join me in conversation about his own story, his teaching and scholarship, and why, to echo him, the Bible matters in our current moment. So welcome, Blake. It's really great to have you on.
Thanks, Greg. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. I was going to say you kindly agreed or foolishly agreed while you're on sabbatical, but I really do appreciate it.
Well, sabbatical could, for all of its benefits, can be a little lonely. So it's nice to have some time for conversation.
That's true. And I have to say, I've said this before on the podcast, it's... you know, I don't know when the last time you and I talked. I mean, these podcasts are a chance to really talk with
colleagues. Right, gosh, it's probably pre-COVID.
I think it's pre-COVID, honestly. I mean, except for maybe some emails. Nuts how busy we get, even on a small campus like Gustavus. Anyway, it's great to chat with you this way. And so you're in St. Peter. I'm up here in Minneapolis. So you're on sabbatical for the – have you been on sabbatical for the year? It's not just this –
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, good. That's great. Excellent. Well, maybe we'll get into that to the extent you're willing to. Some people don't want to talk about what they're doing on sabbatical, but if you are. I've been asking – colleagues and students about their, I know we kind of think COVID is behind us. Let's hope so. I'm not sure it is, but what it was like for you during the pandemic to teach. We all had to be online at one point. That's when I actually started the podcast right around that time. What was it like for you? What are your memories of teaching amid the plague?
Right. I mean, profoundly disorienting. It everything seemed to happen so quickly, and you know, we're cruising along with what was a normal semester. And then within a matter of just a couple of weeks, we pivoted to being completely online, campus shut down. And then, I mean, a good 2 years sort of working our way back in one degree or another, some teaching online, some teaching online, hybrid in person, wearing masks in the classroom, having desks spread out. So for 2.5 years, it was really disruptive.
It's funny. I totally repressed that business about the seating arrangements once we came back.
We had to have seating charts in case we needed to do a contact trace.
Right. Yeah, it was profoundly disorienting is right. I don't know about you. I had done very little. Maybe it's just true of most of us in the humanities. I'd never taught online that I can think of. And, you know, if I never hear the words asynchronous and synchronous again, that would be just fine. But I don't know, once I got into the groove, you know, basically I was running discussion-based courses anyway. Yep. How did that, were you lecturing too, or how did it go for you?
No, it was mostly discussion-based. I did appreciate the way that discussion boards and some of the different online technologies for discussion. And I could really see it the semester that we started, the very first semester we started in person, then we shifted to online. Yeah. Students who, for whatever reason, might not have talked in class very frequently in person, some of them really, really came out of their shells and shone online. Just something yes. about that format clicked with them. And, you know, you suspect it all along and you're reading what they're writing and you know they have these great ideas that for whatever reason they're just not sharing in class and right. now they are sharing them.
Yeah, I had the same experience. In fact, that's one thing I still do. It's been interesting yep. to talk, and maybe you too. I've kept that. What is it called? Yeah, well, no. I use the Moodle forum.
Yep. Posting. No, me too.
Yeah. And there's some right. yeah, amazing, you know, students who've said nothing right. out loud. My God, they've, you know, wow. please speak yeah. up.
It's no, and so and I think that, I mean, looking back for you know, certainly I wouldn't go through it again given the choice, but I think there are ways that the pivot probably made all of us better teachers, introduced us to new pedagogies and, yeah. and gave us more tools for getting more students engaged.
Yeah, I agree. I hate to say silver linings to a pandemic, right. but and the other thing, of course, is we had, I mean, some of our colleagues at other institutions, quote unquote, pivoted in, you know, like 48 hours or something. We at right. least had some time to do it. And Gustavus was really great about that.
Yeah, just the job that Gustavus Technology Services did, yeah. just
you know, heroic,
introducing us to all these new technologies yeah. and just getting us all from no experience to being, you know, semi pros at it within right. a matter of a few weeks. They just did an amazing yeah, job. Yeah,
it was, it truly was. It was amazing. It really was amazing to see and experience. Well, we shall see what happens. Hopefully it is behind us, or at least the worst of it. Right. The place I like to start usually, and I don't know, maybe this is a historian in me or maybe a clause, I don't know what, a biographer, I don't know what it is, sure. but I love to start with people's backgrounds. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
So I grew up in rural South Georgia, working class family, but large family, grandparents, great grandparents, aunts and uncles.
What part of Georgia? What were you near?
It's about 2.5 hours south of Atlanta. It's okay. more or less right in the geographic center of the state. I say South Georgia, but I think for most people, anything south of Atlanta is South Georgia.
South, yeah, okay. Right. And a big family, I mean, so literally all under one roof or just close
no,
by?
No, no, small, you know, yeah. small two-sibling nuclear family, but just mm-hmm. a lot of relatives nearby. And pretty much all of my direct ancestors since before the Civil War had all lived in that part of Georgia.
Wow, that's neat.
And so
Confederates in the attic or not, do you know?
No, definitely. I have at least five or six direct ancestors who fought for the Confederacy, slave owners in the family, which is something, you know, it's interesting. I got interested in family history, genealogy at a really like young, precocious age, partly because I was hearing all of these stories from older family members, this really rich oral tradition, and I could go see family members' graves. And that, I think that in some ways it was a really formative experience. I mean, it you know, as a teenager, I'm starting to think about questions that are hugely important in biblical studies, like the relationship between history and memory, yeah. and the relationship between land and identity. But, you know, at the time in the late 80s, early 1990s, I mean, Georgia still had the Confederate flag as part right. of the state flag. And I wasn't asking I hadn't been encouraged or given permission to ask some really hard questions about, you know, my family's role in all of that and what it means for me. And that's something I've come back to even just in the last few years, you know, post Charlottesville, post George right. Floyd. What does it mean to have that Southern legacy, being the descendant of enslavers and Confederate soldiers?
Yeah, that's profound. And there are a number of authors and some historians mm-hmm. too, who write about that. I mean, historians who, you know, grew up, I don't know about you. I mean, just let's talk about, so I'm teaching a course on the Civil War and abolitionism, as I mentioned mm-hmm. before we started recording this spring. What growing up, I mean, what you're growing up, when are you going to high school, in the 80s or 90s?
Early 90s.
So what was, What were you learning about the Civil War? Was it even referred to as the Civil War?
No, it was. Yeah, it was. I came after all of the War of Northern Aggression nonsense. You know, it was the Civil War.
It was the Civil War. Yeah.
I mean, there was, you know, I was still taught that it was about states' rights in many respects, but the role of slavery wasn't completely glossed over or downplayed. But what really, I think, looking back, the biggest omission was learning about Reconstruction.
Oh, wow.
Reconstruction was the part that was just really glossed over. It was presented as this sort of brief period when, you know, the victorious North just really tried to stick it to the defeated South and the carpetbaggers and all of that. And then, you know, fortunately that got fixed. And it's only as an adult that I've realized, you know, what an amazing and missed opportunity Reconstruction was, how close we came, maybe closer than we ever have since to truly realizing some of the American ideals.
True
of
multiracial.
Freedom.
That's right.
No, yeah.
Everything you're saying. Wow. It's wonderful. That a number of reactions here. One, some of us historians focus on, you know, how is the Civil War taught, but what about Reconstruction, which is incredibly important, and the extent to which there is just all kinds of exciting new scholarship about Reconstruction coming out by historians. I'm thinking of their work.
Sure.
And in fact, I just had an email from our colleague Jill Locke in PoliSci, and she's planning to teach a course on Reconstruction.
Oh, that's so great.
Everything you just said, historians sometimes call it the unfinished second revolution.
Right, right.
I'm
gonna have to sit in on Jill's class.
Yeah, me too.
fill in that gap in my own education.
Yeah, I said to her, I'd love to teach it with her. But that's actually a very interesting point. Not just how is the Civil War taught in Southern high schools and elementary schools, but Reconstruction itself, if it's even there, to the extent that it's there. Very interesting. So you mentioned, I guess I think of my own class background, I think of, if I had to say, petty bourgeois. I don't know. My mother grew up on a farm in what we call Southern Illinois, downstate Illinois, which was south to me. And then my dad was son of a barber, Greek immigrants. And then he became a hairdresser, didn't go to college. But so I guess, you know, I think of, I don't know if I'm petty bourgeois, whatever I would say, but you said working class in your own case. What were your parents doing?
My dad was a number of different jobs. He was for probably a decade, worked at a local manufacturing plant, and eventually had worked his way up to being the assistant plant manager. No high school education, but got first job out of high school and just worked his way up and in a manufacturing job that way. My mom did paraprofessionals, like secretarial work, and then took some time off when my sister was born to raise us and get us started through school. And it was a time when two people without college educations, you know, in the 80s and the 90s could still make a really comfortable middle class life for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Pre-crash all the time. Right. Well, so was religion a significant part of your household growing up?
Not so much during my earliest years. I mean, we lived just down the road from the little country church that my family had attended forever. In fact, my great-great-grandfather had been kicked out of that church for cussing out his mule.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
and they would send me occasionally, or some family members would take me, but they weren't deeply religious themselves. That all changed around the time I was 10, and there was a death in the family, my great grandfather, and the church community really reached out and showed just real kindness to my family that led to them becoming much more active in church. So then,
did that church have a denomination, or was it?
It was Southern Baptist.
Southern Baptist.
There were, I think, 41 Southern Baptist churches in the county I grew up in, and not even double digits for any other denomination. And that's not counting the other varieties of Baptists.
Yeah, Baptist.
The free will Baptists and the primitive Baptists. And
that's amazing. So But no one, had any earlier relatives gone to college? Now you're a first gen, it sounds like.
Earlier, no direct, some of my grandparents or great grandparents, some aunts or uncles. So my own parents weren't farmers, but did, not surprisingly, come from a farming family. And sure. Several great uncles had agriculture degrees. And then an aunt and a cousin were teachers, and so had degrees, master's degree in one case, and in education.
Neat. Were you? What about in your own case? I mean, were you already? Look, I remember this is. I was an altar boy in the Episcopal. I was baptized in the Greek Orthodox Church. Apparently, my dad. And then, I do remember. I'm old enough to remember going to a service. I've said this before, I think, on the podcast. The main thing I remember is communion. This incredibly good Greek bread, scratch made was the
great.
No wafer, man. It was the bread. Yeah,
right. That's the body of Christ.
That's right the body there, right there, baby. That's I still remember that. Anyway, and then then my father kind of moved to the suburbs of Chicago. We went to the Episcopal Church, where I was an altar boy. But I don't recall. I mean, religion was there in our household, but it was more sort of a. My father would cross himself at dinner and maybe say something. We went to church, most Sundays, not always. Anyway, in my own case, I do remember my brother and I going through a phase where we liked to put on, we were little kids. I mean, maybe, we must have been grade school. I think. Anyway, put on our bathrobes and pretend to be the Episcopal priest. We try to imitate his wife. Were you doing that? I mean, when did religion come into you?
I totally was. Even though my family wasn't as actively religious early in my childhood, I still got books of illustrated Bible stories as birthday gifts. And so fascinated by the Bible from an early age, not surprisingly. But no, I think at one time, I don't know if it still exists, my mother still had like a cassette of me pretending to be the preacher, and she had to sit and listen to me. And then we took a plate and I passed her a plate and she had to put some change in it.
Fabulous. Jeez, I wish I had thought of that. We could have maybe made some more money, my brother. Brilliant. Supplement the allowance. That's fantastic.
Baptists know how to do that pretty well, the different offerings.
If you find that tape, we're editing that in. We'll add that as an addendum to the record. That's fantastic.
I'm not sure if I hope it still exists or not.
I hope it does. The historian in me. That's wonderful. Did you, what about so-called, if we can use that phrase, in high school, academic interests, were you drawn to particular subjects in school?
Yeah, I was particularly drawn to my English classes. It's always enjoyed, really bookish. I mean, part of living out in the country, I didn't necessarily have a lot of friends my age, so I spent a lot of time reading growing up. So at some point, really developed a love of poetry and had some... I'm grateful. I had some really good high school English teachers who nurtured that. So actually, I'm interested in the Bible. I'm interested in English literature. I went to college thinking I was going to be a part-time pastor and high school English teacher. And actually, I picked, we mentioned earlier, not a lot of college attendance among family members. So not a lot of real background in even picking a college. And most of the pastors I knew growing up weren't even college educated, but the few that I knew who were had all gone to Mercer University. So I decided I'd go to Mercer University too. And then, and looking back, I think I enjoyed the Bible. I had a deep interest in the Bible. And I think the desire to be a pastor was the only career I could envision at the time where I'd get to have a career that involved the Bible. And then I got to Mercer, took some religion classes at Mercer, despite having been warned that they were too liberal by some well-meaning pastors back home, and discovered that the academic study of religion and realized that that was where my gifts were. And that's what really drew me. And then I've been able to combine that with my appreciation for literature and my focus on biblical poetry. So there were a lot of different threads that seemed disconnected that really got tied together in a really fun way in college and set me on the trajectory that led me here.
And that's, I'm just thinking what, you know, Andrew Del Banco has this book. I think it's Del Banco, What is College For? And that's a great answer. That's one thing it's for, is to try to figure out what those threads are, to understand those threads better and tie them together, see how they relate. Right. That's really cool. So what did you wind up majoring in, maybe you said, I apologize, majoring in English?
I was a double major in English and religion.
And religion, yeah. Yep. Were the faculty at Mercer, were they... I'm asking out of complete ignorance. At that time, were the people teaching your Bible courses, let's say, were they also pastors themselves?
Some of them were, yeah. Uh-huh. And they were, I mean, it was a serious academic religion department, but also, and I think this was key for me, they were also, I think all of the professors were also themselves deeply devout, which is... I mean, that's actually a fraught question in the study of religion now, is being yourself a person of faith, a help or a hindrance in being in the academic study of religion. But I think for me, seeing that they were themselves, they could combine their own deep faith with a study of religion that sometimes asked uncomfortable questions and then led to uncomfortable answers, that really made for a soft entry for me. I knew I could follow in their steps, start asking the kinds of questions they asked, start reading the Bible the way they did, and I didn't have to worry that I would lose my faith as a result.
Yeah, that fraught question is on my list here, and we had it under we get to your scholarship, but you kind of answered it already, that you can be devout and also still be a scholar, and adhering to scholarly standards, in this case regarding biblical studies. That must have been an amazing, I mean, it's not a moment, I guess you didn't wake up and but still formative, obviously, in so many ways for Mercer. But what point did you think about graduate school?
I mean, I think it was probably about midway through. I was really enjoying the classes and realized, I'd gone in thinking I wanted to be a teacher, but I also wanted a career that, kept me engaged with the Bible and realizing that, it clicked at some point about halfway through that academic biblical studies would give me the chance to do both, when I was imagining having to have two separate careers going in to be able to do that. And I was lucky. One professor in particular in the department really took me under his wing, encouraged me to write a senior honors thesis on Paradise Lost.
Oh, wow.
but looking at that, it was through the religion department, looking at a theological idea in it.
Perfect.
And he really mentored me about going to grad school and the places I should be looking and what I should be thinking.
Yeah. Well, why Princeton? Was it, I mean, had that been on your radar even? Probably not growing up.
Oh, no. Gosh, yeah. No. No, I mean, it was... He recommended it along with a couple of other programs that he thought would really, getting an MDiv at these programs would keep the door open for being a pastor one day. I never went through that door, but it did keep it open while also preparing me for PhD work. And so I did a visit to Princeton. It was the first time I'd ever flown by myself on an airplane. Did a campus visit my senior year, and it just, you just have that feeling. This is the right place. I can see myself here.
Yeah. I'm trying to think who was Cornel West. Wasn't there? Was he when you were there? No, he already.
No, he was at the university.
He was at the university.
Right.
That's right. He was at the university.
But he was there for part of the time. There was a little cafe I like to work in grad school, and sometimes you'd see him in there reading with his big hair.
Yeah. Oh man, cafes and professors and love cafes.
That's one of the things I love about St. Peter is River Rock Coffee.
Oh my gosh. Plug for River Rock. I'm trying to podcast with Helena, one of the co-owners. Who's an alum, was a chemistry major at Gustavus. Thank God for River Rock. I was still up here in the Twin Cities. That's where I work. I'm with you. So that isn't, I mean, another question I had for you, I mean, that seems like, quite a, a leap. I mean, given your background and everything, I don't mean that you're not capable. I mean, just in terms of culture and family, was it, were there tensions at all between you and your parents? Were they just simply proud of you, or did they feel, hey, you're becoming, you're becoming not one of us?
No, they were, they were incredibly supportive.
That's nice.
From the beginning. I mean there's definitely some sadness. I think they realized, certainly, you know, by the time I was going to grad school, that I was really probably embarking on a path that, that meant I would never live close to them.
And, right.
And there'd be this distance. So there, there was certainly sadness about that. But no, they were nothing but, and have, you know, since been nothing but supportive.
That's great. Fortunate. Yeah. So what did you wind up doing as your dissertation work? I gather it was focused on the Bible and poetry or prophets. Yeah,
specifically the poetry of Isaiah. So my book, Reading the Poetry of Isaiah, is a revised version of the dissertation.
Dissertation. Okay.
And just really trying to, I mean, it's pretty, I mean, I think most people accept that there's poetry in the Bible, especially the Psalms. Most English translations set certain biblical texts off as poetry typographically, with the line breaks and the white space. But I think particularly with some prophetic books, there's still not as robust an appreciation that we read that these texts are poems and whatever else we read them for historical information, for theology, you know, we're, that is being mediated through their poetic form. And if you don't get the poetic form right, you might not get some of these other things right.
Yeah. You're reminding me, you know, I took, I was an undergraduate at Northern Illinois University, and I took a Bible course that I don't think couldn't have been required. It must have been in an English, by an English professor. God, his name, Professor Orville Baker. I can picture him perfectly. I absolutely loved the course. I'm trying to think if we, what would we have used, the Dartmouth Bible, maybe? Edition. Yeah. I think I still have it, by the way. Somewhere. I do. I know I marked it up.
Sure.
But I imagine, I mean, I don't know how, to what extent he was teaching any aspects of it as poetry, but certainly as literature, which I guess is more common. I mean, the prophet I'm most, I guess, familiar with is Jeremiah, just because of the concept of the American Jeremiah.
And, right.
But is that, you would consider that poetry as well? Can a Jeremiah be poetry?
Hey, Jeremiah is a mix of poetry and prose. And I mean, if you just look at any modern English translation, you'll sort of see that reflected. But yeah, a lot of the really memorable, particularly in the first half of the book, the stories about Jeremiah tend to be prose narrative, but the actual speeches of Jeremiah, the original, you know, Jeremiads, are a lot of them are poetry, and really really beautiful poetry.
Yeah, that's really so cool. Do you write poetry?
I don't. I do. I write some semi-autobiographical, you know, nonfiction essay type, but I've never the little bit of poetry I've written was just, it was not great and wasn't fulfilling. So
okay.
I just, those who can't do teach, right?
Yeah, right. I'm asking partly because, you know, we have, as you well know, we have so many great poets at Gustavus, associated with Gustavus, some of whom I podcast with, some of whom unfortunately have passed on, but just, you know, amazing. So somehow it's fitting that we have you working on
that. Oh, no, and it's been so great to have, you know, have them as colleagues, to, you know, talk poetry with Bill Bryant and enjoy Sudfin.
Right.
And also, you know, the comparative literature minor is a way of bringing people together from English, from modern languages, from classics, from religion, and very much just fits with my approach to biblical poetry, that this is, you know, it's religious poetry, and it certainly, that religious element is indispensable, but it's still world poetry and should have a place in any discussion of global comparative literature.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I will never forget that professor, just, you know, helping me understand and appreciate the Bible as literature, as art. Right. And then I subsequently, I think I, yeah, it was either, must have been after the Bible course, I took a course with him on Shakespeare, which was also, sure. I still have that book as well.
Oh, of course. Anyway,
but so that quote that I started with comes, I think you said that, I don't know if you said it out loud or wrote it, but it was during the fairly recent Nobel conference at, sure. Gustavus, our annual Nobel conference on climate change, as you know. And I was really struck by that quote. I mean, someone could say, I imagine a lot of people would say, well, the Bible is always relevant to one's current moment. It's the Bible, for God's sake, right?
Right.
But you mean it in a different way. And I'm just curious if you'd elaborate on that. Tell us a little bit about, it's interesting how you came to realize I'm a biblical scholar and I, in fact, have something to say about climate change, as does the Bible.
Yeah, when people talk about the relevance of the Bible, they often focus specifically on the history of a biblical interpretation, the way people have read the Bible and thought about it, and the role it's played in religious communities and in public life. And from that perspective, the Bible, for a lot of climate activists, for a lot of environmental activists, the Bible is public enemy number one.
Exactly.
The book of Genesis, the first creation story in Genesis 1, gives humans dominion over the rest of creation, and especially animals. And there's the sense, and this goes back to a really formative article by an ecologist named Lynn White, I want to say in the 50s.
Okay.
About the Bible and the environmental crisis, and that dominion has given people a license for exploitation without regard for the consequences. And I think that may be slightly overstated, but is certainly undeniable. But so that's one way. But if you look at the Bible fresh, you know, respecting and keeping in mind the history of how it has been used, but recognizing that doesn't have to dictate the ways it continues to be used. I mean, it's the product of an ancient agrarian society where people live much closer to the land than certainly many of us comfortable Westerners, and have, you know, and engage with the land and animals, and you start to notice there are ways of thinking about the land and ways of thinking about human animal relations and the world that are very different from our own, and I think complicate that narrative that the Bible is public enemy number one. So thinking about the land having agency, giving, you know,
yes.
things like, you know, what we think of as just, you know, crop rotation, letting land lie fallow, that's actually giving the land a Sabbath, the same Sabbath break that's commanded for humans, which incidentally, that commandment in the Ten Commandments includes not only humans, but animals get the day off too.
Yes.
And so that's just one example. And then in prophetic literature, there's a lot of apocalyptic imagery of the destruction of the earth that is specifically connected to the misdeeds of humans, the exploitativeness of humans, both exploiting other human beings and exploiting the environment. And so the idea that human action is a major factor in something like climate change. I mean, that's the biblical prophets were thousands of years ago thinking, yeah, we can really screw up the earth if we're not careful.
Yeah, and there's that catastrophic flood, I think, if I
remember. Yeah, yeah, right. No, it's ironic that so at the end of the flood, God is making the promise to Noah, I'll never again flood the earth. And there's this really beautiful line, you know, that, you know, I'm actually thinking of it not from the Bible, but as it got worked into the hymn, "Great is thy faithfulness, suntime and winter, summer, winter, planting, harvest, the earth will endure." And that's actually cited. I think it was Senator Jim Inhofe cited that as evidence that the climate can never change. But that comes at the end of a story about how the evil, the violence of humans caused a flood. Yeah. I mean, if that is a warrant for thinking human action can change the climate, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I hope Senator Inhofe's listening. Good Lord. Yeah, no, I love that. You wrote about that. It's so amazing. Yeah. I think, I mean, you know, what's occurring to me as you speak, it's the same with slavery in a way, right? You can point, I mean, you know, the Bible can be seen as
right.
enemy number one with respect to slavery and the sanctioning of slavery. So people point to what the curse of
sure.
Ham and then, yep. and then also to, was it Paul, servants obey thy masters.
Yeah. Yep.
But at the same time, right. And you've written about this, you and your co-author have written about this recently, the way in which the Bible can be used, to counter slavery was, I mean, not just now, but at by abolitionists, especially around the, not just, but especially around the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. You've written about that. Anyway, I wonder, a couple of questions. I'd like you to talk about that work, that recent article, which is just superb. That appeals to the historian
to me
because it is history. Yeah, and I'll be, before we started recording, as I said, I'm teaching a course on abolitionism this spring. I'll be using that, assigning that article.
Oh, I'm honored.
Oh, well, it's excellent work. So talk a little bit about that. But then I'm also wondering, this is a bigger question as we speak, is the Bible just, and take these in whatever order you want, is the sure. Bible just one of those texts then that can be read however one wants it to be read?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good questions. I'll start with the smaller question. The article actually has a really fun origin story. A good friend of mine from grad school that I've kept in touch with, Jeremy Skipper, who's now at the University of Toronto, has written some really, really great work on the Bible and American history and with slavery and race in the Bible. Actually just has a recent book out about the role of scripture in the revolt by Denmark Vesey.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. No wonder his name. You know what? That's interesting. Yeah. Hello. I know that book. I haven't read it, but I know of it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Yeah.
So he, you know, for some research he was doing, it was actually on an article about the curse of Ham. He was reading this very, very odious pro-slavery writer who made this really weird allusion to an otherwise obscure text in Isaiah that I had worked with just before, just as a poetic text. It's a prophetic oracle against the kingdom of Moab, the neighbor of the ancient Israelites and Judeans across the Jordan River. Really, really stunning poetry. He just sent me email, said, hey, there's this really weird reference to Isaiah 16 in Fletcher. And I read it and I thought, there's some backstory here. So we exchanged some emails and we started doing just some, we started with just some Google searches and then looked at, you know, Google Books and the HathiTrust, got to right, some actual, you know, primary sources
great,
from the period.
Great resource, the HathiTrust.
Oh, I know. God. Yeah.
Fabulous.
And realize there's this whole use that, as far as we could tell, no one had documented of quoting a line from this prophecy against Moab, which in the King James Bible is hide the outcast, and this pro, you know, using that on the part of abolitionists, particularly to as biblical warrant for assisting people who are escaping slavery.
Yes.
And opposing the various Fugitive Slaves Acts. Hide the outcast became a favorite line of William Lloyd Garrison. It was included in the preface to William Frederick Douglass's autobiography.
Right.
Associated with the execution of John Brown. And this pro-slavery writer was trying, we ultimately concluded, to discredit that widespread abolitionist use of the Bible. So that led to this co-authored article that was a lot of fun to write and an area, I mean, I'm obviously interested in the history of interpretation of Isaiah, but it hadn't really to that point been a major research focus, but just this one offhanded reference that was so weird that the author called Cincinnati the Moab of the South because of the, you know, fugitive
right
enslaved persons escaping to it, and then that just trying to figure out why he would use that language that way uncovered this whole really interesting history of how the text was used.
This makes me want to go back to Harry Beecher Stowe, which I've taught Uncle Tom's Cabin so many times. What she's got in there, if anything, about Isaiah. It's awesome. It's a great origin story. It's an example to especially student listeners of how, you know, how we don't always sit around and this, you know, a topic then just comes to us, right? Yep. Some of this is serendipity, as my colleague David Obermiller likes to say. That's really cool. Go ahead.
Indulge your curiosity and, you know, like this is interesting. I want to figure out more about it and trust your hunch that there's more to it than there appears to be on the surface. Because there probably is.
Yeah. And as we were talking before we started recording, David Blight, who was here last spring, whose magnificent biography of Frederick Douglass, and he's been working on Douglass for decades, but anyway, won the Pulitzer in 2018.
Sure.
The subtitle, the title, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And I know in the book, I mean, he writes about Douglass's use of Isaiah and Jeremiah in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, Douglass is a Jeremiah. So anyway, fascinating article. And I think, it leads me to that other question. Is it like the Constitution, the Bible? Is it like it's just one of those texts that you can read whatever the hell you want to read into it?
I think there's certainly an element of that. I mean, I think ultimately when you study the history of biblical interpretation, you learn as much or more about the interpreters than you do about the Bible itself.
Sure.
I do think also, though, that in the case of the Bible, and this is just part of what makes it so interesting to study. I mean, it's not even though the word Bible literally means book, it's not a single book. It's a collection of documents that were put together over a period of, nearly 1,000 years, different historical settings, different authors from different social locations. And so it's a really diverse text. There are, perspectives that are raised in some biblical books are sometimes directly challenged in other biblical books. And so I think part of what lends the Bible to being capable of being cited in both sides of arguments is that, it actually makes both arguments, reflecting the diversity within it as a collection of texts.
And the diversity, as you're saying, I had noted this earlier when you were speaking, the diversity of the historical contexts in which it was written. It's not written at just one moment. And you see, you're a historian. I mean, your attention to historical context it just comes through in your work, especially this article, of course. What about, I'm curious too about what it's like, let me preface it by saying, in all the years I've been at Gustavus, only once did I have a direct question about history and, I guess it would have been Christianity. You know, what do we teach a parent wanting to? I think she wanted me to say yes. Do we teach history from a Christian perspective? And I said no. but I'm just curious. You know, when you're teaching about the Bible at a school that is, affiliated with the ELCA, mainstream, mainline, whatever, Lutheranism. Well, and, not all our students are Lutheran by any means. And even if they are, they may not know squat about the Bible. I'm just curious what do our students bring to your classes regarding the Bible? And what is it like to teach them about the Bible as you understand it from your scholarly perspective?
I mean, We do have an increasingly diverse student body, which is wonderful. Increasingly students who are not from Christian backgrounds, increasing numbers of Muslim students, Jewish students, Buddhist students. But still, the majority of students are Lutheran or Catholic. Many of them come from that background, but come to Gustavus having already, if not outrightly dismissed it, certainly having serious questions about it. Not all of them, but some of them. And in a lot of ways, I think that, I mean, the danger is that they think they already know what the Bible says, and so they don't have anything to learn about it. But I think in other ways that puts them in a really interesting place to be exposed to the Bible. And some of the Some of the compliments I've gotten from my classes from students that have really meant the most have been from students who have, for whatever reason, rejected the Christian faith of their childhood, but then told me, I'd never realized the Bible was as interesting or as serious as it is.
That's great.
And it, you know, they're not necessarily re-embracing their childhood faith, but they are now aware that the Bible is a serious text, and that whatever you end up believing about it, you know, it raises questions of meaning and value and poses answers that deserve to be taken seriously as options.
Yes. I was going to ask you this question. It sort of relates here. Maybe I'll just pose it as a statement. The Bible, it seems to me, is like, it's like an urtext of the liberal arts in some ways.
Right.
You know, I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I mean, go ahead if you want to.
Well, I mean, I mean, obviously there's, again, the history of biblical interpretation, all the great, certainly, literature that alludes to the Bible, responds to and interrogates the Bible. But also the fun thing about biblical studies and about the study of the academic study of religion more generally is it's so inherently interdisciplinary. I use both historical approaches, and I engage literary theory in my work, and you know, other colleagues are deeply involved in conversations between theology and philosophy, or use social scientific methodologies to study how religious communities form and interact and work on the ground. So, you know, and that's, I mean, in some ways that's a plug for being a religion major and for
absolutely
for majoring in religion, having religion as your another a dual major with some other topic is it's inherently interdisciplinary. And so in that sense, I think it can be a kind of a playground for liberal arts skills. Oh,
well said. Yeah. And it raises, I mean, all of the big questions that we want our students to wrestle with, that we all wrestle with as human beings, I think, if we're thinking and learning, questions of meaning, of value, and on and on and on.
And I like to tell my students that, you know, I hope they learn a lot of things from my classes, but one thing I really want them to take away is that there is some, you know, this is a very humanities approach, but there is some human artifact out there that you may have discovered yet or may not. It could be a literary work, it could be a song, it could be a philosophical or historical question, it could be a work of art, but some human artifact out there that you can engage with and find meaning and value from for the rest of your life. And you'll always come to it from different places in life, and you'll get new things out of it. For me, the Bible is one of those texts. It certainly could be for you, but it doesn't have to be the Bible. But I do hope that seeing how the Bible can be this kind of, that you can have this kind of lifelong relationship with the Bible, opens to you the possibility that there's some work out there that you can have a similar relationship with that will just inform the way you think about yourself and the world for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, you again just reminded me of, I don't think this is a false or recovered memory. I was in camp, maybe in junior high. I went to a Boy Scout camp. It may have only been a weekend. And the Boy Scouts and I did not agree. I mean, it was a bad combo for a lot of reasons.
Sure.
But what I remember is feeling really, I was not happy, not a happy camper.
And no pun intended.
I wouldn't have brought the Bible with me. There must have been a Bible. This is what I remember doing, turning to the Bible for comfort, just reading it. I mean, so there you go. I mean, this is when I was, I think that's right. I'm pretty sure it was the Bible. It must have been there, you know, who knows, in the tent or wherever.
Sure.
Anyway, that's all well said. Right. And it can be the Bible. It can be a painting. It can be a novel.
Right,
it can be all of the above. It seems to me that's what it means to be liberally educated and being learning for life, as I like to say. You know, the other thing is, we're going to wind down here, but I do want to talk about your involvement in the, you mentioned the comparative literature. It's a minor, right? Is that right?
Yep, it is. Yeah. Yes.
Which is really cool. And then just your, what attracted you to the gender, women, sexuality studies, the GWSS program? What's your involvement
in that? It's my very first year at Gustavus. There was a class in the books that had been taught previously called Women in the Bible. It wasn't necessarily an area of direct research focus for me, but I'd done some work in it. So I said, sure, I'll take the class. And the class already contributed to both the religion major minor and the gender women sexuality studies major minor. So I got students from both in the very first class, and it was wonderful. They were great students. Mm-hmm. The conversation that came from, you know, these really committed feminists who are able to do some really, really cutting edge gender analysis, and these, you know, and in one case, a more conservative religion major who actually, you know, this was 2010, said that she really was uncomfortable using the word feminist to describe herself. And, you know, they just, these great conversations around the text, and there's so many rich texts about women and gender, some really, really disturbing ones, of
yes.
course, but some, you know, right. like enslavement, like some of these other issues, but also some really fascinating ones. And so from that moment, it became one of my favorite classes to teach. I've since incorporated more of an element of not just feminist biblical scholarship, but also gender studies. You know, added the word gender to the title, women, gender, and Bible. We look as well at, you know, the way that masculinity is constructed in the Bible, sure. as well as femininity. And And so then that was my entrance to getting involved in the GWSS program, which is, I think, the oldest of our interdisciplinary programs.
I think so. I believe so.
And just, it really brings together faculty from, you know, a wide array of disciplines, some of the usual suspects like English and modern languages and philosophy and religion, but, you know, also communications, the physicist, and who are really committed to using gender as a tool for analysis, as a frame for thinking about their own disciplines, and showing students that it is like any topic, that it is one that can repay close critical study from a variety of disciplinary perspectives.
Right. And of course, the Bible number one too for a lot of feminists. And I mean, I'm thinking now Elizabeth Cady Stanton's the women's Bible?
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It sounds great. And when you describe the conversations in that course, if there's a heaven, that's heaven for me, at least heaven any professor. No better feeling.
And it was, the first several times I taught it, it would get six or eight, you know, usually single digit number of students, you know, which makes for some good discussions. But sort of post 2016, post Me Too, you know, it now fills and has waiting lists, you know, 20 students every single time I've taught it.
And, that's fantastic. That's really excellent. Yeah,
and it you know, it's an opportunity to look at, you know, this text is the product of a what we would call a patriarchal society. And there are a lot of, one phrase that is used in feminist biblical scholarship is texts of terror. There are lots of biblical texts that are texts of terror for women and for sexual minorities.
Right.
And you can't ignore that, and you've got to address that head on. And yet within that, there are biblical texts. It's more complicated, though, than just that. Even some of the most patriarchal texts, you can sort of tease away in a few of them, maybe some degree of self-awareness and even discomfort with some of the patriarchal assumptions. And while there are certainly texts that no self-respecting feminist or feminist ally would consider liberating today, there are biblical texts that in that that context would have been quite liberating. Right. And that opens really interesting questions about what does it even mean to be oppressed or liberated?
Exactly.
And how even our concepts of that are culturally constructed.
Exactly. Context.
Historically
again.
Conditioned. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. You know, you've said a lot there that I, at least some of which want to come back to. One, I'm thinking of the, there's something parallel that goes on, at least has gone on among historians with our Constitution and also among abolitionists, as you know, which is, you know, is the Constitution pro-slavery, period, end of story, or could it also be read as some abolitionists, eventually Frederick Douglass, not William sure. Lloyd Garrison, but Douglass eventually, and some historians now also some, could it also be read as anti-slavery? So mm-hmm. there's that. The other thing you touch on, sexual minorities, do you identify as a gay man? Is that?
That's right.
Yep. Okay. Yep. So as a gay man, when I think of the Bible and I think of all of the, I shouldn't say all, I don't, but you know, the ways in which it has been used homophobically, if that's a
sure.
word, what has that been like for you as you've confronted the Bible over the years, as you've wrestled with the Bible? Is that something you just sort of acknowledge and then find ways in which it's affirming?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's another one of those, it's complicated cases. I mean, I know that it's complicated. Seems like the liberal arts professor's answer to everything, but it's
correct.
It's,
we get made fun
it's
of.
It's true, yeah. and yeah. I mean, it's yeah. you know, learning.
It is true.
I think learning to deal constructively with the complexities of life
exactly.
is one of the greatest gifts of a liberal arts education.
Couldn't agree more.
So I mean, yeah. I mean, first of all, when there certainly are biblical texts that have been used in ways that are homophobic. One has to figure out what are these texts actually talking about? What's the construction of sexuality behind them? And I think that in some cases, you know, the text, whatever the text says, it's coming from such a different understanding of human sexuality and what matters and what's valuable about it that even the people who are using it homophobically today would not buy into entirely. Mm-hmm. And again, that, you know, the Bible is a, you know, diverse collection of documents. There are, you know, certainly texts that, if not, you know, probably not what we would necessarily think of as committed same-sex relationships in a, you know, in a world where gay marriage is increasingly accepted. But certainly there are texts that really value, you know, same-sex sociability in positive ways that I think in our society could learn from, not necessarily even in a way that moves into affirming, outrightly affirming of sexual minorities, but just becoming a little less heteronormative.
Yes. And, yeah.
So there's... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's just, it's complicated.
Yeah. I'm just thinking here, I don't know if that's something that I've read some psychology around this issue, but you know what distinguishes the so-called liberal mind from let's say the closed-minded
sure.
mind is that comfort with complexity, and that's even true of politics, right? So if you're looking
sure.
for, I'm thinking of Douglas and Lincoln. I mean, if you're looking for purity, then Lincoln, and you're an abolitionist, Lincoln isn't
right.
your guy. But if you're looking right. for the best game in town, right, at the time,
yeah.
he is. So anyway, I think it's just extremely interesting to look at that text mm-hmm. Whether it's the Constitution, the Bible, or otherwise, in all its complexity, as you do. You were going to say something. It sounds like, go ahead.
You actually anticipated it, that, texts are an indispensable part of our life. I mean, in some way, we're moving to a post-print age, but we still, if anything, encounter more texts than ever.
That's right.
Even text messaging,
the
way it's phrased.
Exactly. Thank you.
But, you know, right. but classic texts like the Bible, the U.S. Constitution, so much wonderful literature being written now, so many great novels, just the the ability to read carefully, critically, and not just passively consume the textual media that are presented to you, but to read carefully and critically, which doesn't, I mean, it sounds boring, but it can all be done with great pleasure
totally.
And it can be great fun. But I think I think it's a skill, you know, it's an indispensable skill for people who want to be contributors to the common good, to American democracy. And it's one that certainly classes like mine, but you know, all humanities classes, certainly, and if not all classes, period, at Gustavus, it's a skill that those classes really help inculcate.
Completely. I mean, well said. And we can't say it enough, apparently, at this.
Right.
Well, the humanities have always, I mean, contrary to what some people think, it's always been kind of rocky. But wow, I could keep going. I want to keep going, but
oh, the time has flown by.
I know.
This has been fun.
Everyone says that. Thank you. The time does fly by for me as well. But as we conclude here, you've already made the case really for the liberal arts and in your discipline, but I wonder if you could reflect just briefly on what is it you enjoy most about being a Gustavus professor?
It's the people. Our students are delightful. They're earnest in ways that are fun, but they're serious, and they take serious things seriously. And there's never a semester that goes, no matter how many times I've taught the class, no matter how familiar I am with the topic, there's never a semester when a student doesn't ask a question or share a perspective that makes me look at my own work and, you know, these things that are so important to me in a new way. And then, you know, our faculty colleagues, I've never known a more committed group of people in my life, committed to their students, to their vocations, to being the best teachers they can be, but also committed to each other and committed to interdisciplinarity and just the wonderful conversations with colleagues from all kinds of disciplines. And those relationships, just really those people just make it such a delightful place to work.
Yeah, ditto to underscore all of that. Then, especially for me, the podcast has been just delightful to get to know. I mean, people I know and I say hello to, but don't really know their stories. For example, I knew you were from Georgia, but that was about it. I mean, I've learned a lot.
I'm loving sabbatical. I'm loving the opportunity to think more broadly and just to catch up on some rest from the exhausting past few years. That personal connection, the people, I do miss that, and I will be. It'll be nice to get back to that, even in the fall when the sabbatical is over.
All right, but no rush.
No rush. Still plenty of time.
Exactly. Hang on to that sabbatical bliss.
No worries there. I'm savoring it for all it's worth.
Good. And best of luck with all your work. And I will be in touch.
Thank you so
much. And I will be in touch about if you want to zoom in. I don't want to intrude too much and be twice now on your sabbatical, but for the abolitionism course.
That'd be great fun.
Great article. And I look forward to assigning and talking with students about it, maybe with your help. So, Blake, it's been fun, a pleasure. I'm going to dig out my Dartmouth Bible. I know I have it somewhere here. I know I have it. I'm sure it's the same one from the 1970s when I was an undergraduate at Northern. Yeah. Maybe I'll bring it into class. This is what it is to mark up a book, mark up a text. But in all seriousness, I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much. Take good care, and enjoy the rest of your sabbatical. All right.
Thanks so much.
See ya. You're welcome. Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by the College's Office of Marketing and Communication, the Provost's Office, Will Clark, Class of 2020, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.